ever Pat Sanders of Leesand Roundtable. And as promised, we are going to bring you an incredible panel, a great roundtable of guests that are here to make sure that we can cover all things Montreal Canadiens, Toronto Maple Leafs. I, of course, first and foremost, I'm talking about a very good friend of the show's and one of our affiliates, Mr. Omar White from Winning Habit is here. Omar, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Middle of the week, and it's a little rainy. But besides that, I'm doing all right.
Well, I'll tell you something. That anecdote was as fascinating as that anecdote was. I'll tell you right now, we're going to get some clear skies in a moment. Why? Because our next guest is a gentleman who works with Sportsnet and can be found all over social media and the interweb, and he's the host of the Andrew Berkshire Show. Andrew Berkshire is here. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good, guys. I'm excited to be back on so quick after being on for the first time just, I guess, a week and a half ago.
Absolutely. We had you on pre-Halloween, and now all hell's broken loose. And to help us talk about that, of course, no roundtable would be complete without the co-host of Habs Fan vs. Leafs Fan, the Habs fan himself, Mr. Kamal Rahman, is here with us as well.
Hey, boys. How's everyone doing out there?
Yeah, same old. Yeah, you're probably pretty happy, you know, considering the Habs have scored a lot. So,
yeah, things have taken quite a turn, and I guess that 3.9 shooting percentage wasn't going to stay for a long time, so I think that's turned around a little bit, but we'll see how that goes.
Looking at this past week, I mean, both you, Omar, and Andrew, you were both on a week ago, and we were talking about doom and gloom associated with Montreal Canadiens. We were talking about the Toronto Maple Leafs being favored to win the Stanley Cup. What a difference a single week makes in the hockey universe. I want to start with you, Andrew. What's really changed over the last week, in your opinion, that you've noticed that maybe is something the average fan isn't noticing about both teams that now we are suddenly understanding?
Perfectly honest, there's not too much that's changed with the Canadiens so far. They're producing a few more scoring chances per game, but they're giving up a lot still. Like the actual run of play hasn't changed that much. It's just that finally, they're starting to get a little bit of luck go their way. Like the game against the Senators, it's easy to look at that and say, wow, they scored 8 goals and they allowed 3, but it was Montoya, so it's not a big deal. They must have played great. But, you know, there's an old saying in hockey that the games that you can learn the least from are blowouts, and that's true of that game because they didn't actually play particularly well against the Senators. They finished almost every one of their shots, especially in the first two periods. But they weren't, you know, incredibly dominant in terms of possession or scoring chances. It was just that, you know, Anderson had a really bad night and the Canadian shooters had a really good night that they were really due for. And it seemed like everybody got the monkey off their back at the same time. You know, like Charles Houdon and Arturi Lehkonen have arguably been the Canadian's two best shooters during, like, the last 10 games, right? Like, they've been popping scoring chances like crazy and not getting rewarded for it. Finally, they both get on the board twice each in one game. You know, like sometimes things like that happen, and it's not too much to read into. The Canadiens aren't as bad as their record, but they are also aren't as good as the last couple games that made them look.
Yeah, actually, if I can jump in there, I think those are a lot of good points made. And I was actually going to, I guess, open up to the floor and say, is the amount of goal scoring that Habs have had lately also tied into, well, like what Andrew brought up, the goaltenders they've been facing? You know, like these three games where they've had the most substantial goal scoring has been against James Reimer, Andre Pavelec, and Craig Anderson. Yeah. And you know, Reimer is Reimer. You know, like we've seen what he can do in Toronto, and even though he's played a whole bunch over the years, you know, he hasn't really stood out as like a full fledged number one goaltender. Same for Pavlik. You know, he's had his stretches of success, but you know, you couldn't really get anything worked out in Winnipeg, and over in New York, he's not doing significantly better. And you know, his rebound control still hasn't improved at all. And then you know, the true challenge they had was against Jonathan Quick, and they got shut out, right? So, you know, so even though, you know, they are finishing up on their chances, you know, can we say that, you know, the goaltender they've been facing has been, you know, an ample explanation for what's been going on as well.
And ironically, I mean, that game against LA was probably their best performance of the season. You know, every shot they seemed to allow went in, and they couldn't get one past Jonathan Quick, but that was a dominant game from start to finish. Like, LA only had one high danger scoring chance on net that entire game. That's how crazy good the Canadiens were in that game. It just, things didn't go well for them, you know, but they played an amazing game. That's why when people were really upset after that loss and I was looking around, people were talking about how bad they were. I was like, what game did you watch, guys? Like, it wasn't even close. Like, they ran into a hot Jonathan Quick, which, you know, that happens once every month or so where he just stops everything. And that's all she wrote.
Let's take a look also at the Maple Leafs, because a week ago I distinctly remember we were all more or less extolling their virtues. All of us, except for Kamal, were gushing about their stellar game in this part. And then they go through this stretch where, for all of their offensive capabilities, is it me or are we starting to see the expected defensive warts starting to rear their ugly heads? Because the lack of bottom six depth on their defensive core in particular, I think you'll agree, Andrew, is maybe starting to show people that they got way too far ahead of themselves this season.
Maybe a little bit, but I think the main problem with Toronto is, you know, the same problem that they've had last year as well, and that their defense is not constructed perfectly, right? Like, you have Morgan Riley and Jake Gardner are very good players, but neither of them are guys that you want on your, like, first pair as, like, a matchup guy, taking hard minutes. So they're kind of too similar, you know? And I wrote about this recently for Sportsnet because my editor asked if, you know, maybe the Leafs would be better if they had taken Noah Hanifin instead of Mitch Marner a couple of years ago. And a lot of people got upset at the headline, you know, of maybe Mitch Marner isn't the be-all, end-all for the Toronto Maple Leafs, but the conclusion was that Hanifin is very similar to Gardner and very similar to Riley. So you don't necessarily need that guy. What they need is, you know, a good shutdown defenseman, not an old guy like Ron Hainsey, but a guy who can take tough minutes and doesn't hurt you offensively in transition. Somebody like a Chris Tanev or Nick Jalmerson, who was traded for peanuts in the summer. And it seems like the Maple Leafs just haven't been able to find the fit there, and either they're not willing to spend the cash on that position, or they just don't know exactly what they're looking for yet. Or maybe they're not as invested in winning a Stanley Cup this year as most people think they are. I mean, would a team think they're going to win the Stanley Cup sign Roman Polak? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting because, like a lot of teams, or like, you know, like a lot of people compare the Leafs to Chicago. So let's use that. You know, if Chicago's blue line, you know, is having a bad night, you know, like, who does Quenneville rely on? You know, he points to Duncan Keith and says, "You're playing 30 minutes today." You know, and if you look on the Leafs, like, they don't really have that one guy who can, you know, who can step up and play like big, like, randomly a whole bunch of minutes one night. Like last year in the playoffs, Gardner and Riley, I think they played close to 40, but that's because I think that was the same night where Paul like broke his leg. So yeah. To Andrew's point, they don't really have that one person who you're 100%, you know, I know you will not mess up, so go on and play. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, they're having these defensive lapses now. And then also you know, you have to look at the forwards too. Like, you know, JVR and Bozak, Marner to an extent as well. They've never really been, you know, the key defensive forwards. But like this season in particular is really standing out to the point where, you know, Babcock is throwing him on the fourth line. So, you know, maybe it's not even just a defensive change, but maybe a change in the forward group as well. And I think you kind of have to think of, you know, if Bozak is struggling so much now, and if it continues this much to the end of the season, like, does this add on to the bowl of reasons of why Bozak shouldn't be brought back next year?
What was going back to Roman Polak, what was the reason for signing Roman Polak, bringing him back? Was it, I mean, he's obviously not a mobile defenseman. Was it to actually shore up the defensive end for Toronto? I mean, is he really that effective of a defensive defenseman?
Well, I'll tell you, Kamal.
Definitely not.
The reason is because he's a good man. He's a good pro, and he does it right every day. That's why he got brought back.
I assume there's also some reasoning in terms of getting him on the penalty kill, because that's like the one area Roman Polak is still pretty decent at is. Mm-hmm. You know, the penalty kill defending is much different than defending at even strength. You can see that in forwards and defensemen. You know, like, guys who are less mobile can kind of just stick near the net and clog off passing lanes, and then you can just, like, wire it down the ice. You know, you don't have to worry about icing. And same thing for forwards where, you know, the same kind of defensive awareness and even strength isn't the, like, it's not the same thing you need for on the penalty kill. You need that, like, agility and quickness back and forth to try to get into passing lanes up high and maybe intercept a pass across the blue line and cause a breakaway, you know? Like, it's a different set of player that's good defensively at even strength and on the penalty kill, and maybe Polak fits there. But the problem is that you still have to have him playing the rest of the game. And, you know, there are more penalties this year because of the crackdown on slashing and the faceoff violations, but is it enough for Roman Polak's incredible deficiencies at even strength to be, like, in the lineup? Probably not. But the thing is, like, every coach in the NHL loves guys like Roman Polak and Matt Martin who, you know, like, the expectations for them are so incredibly low that anytime they somewhat meet them, it's like, oh my God, they're playing great. And it seems like coaches are often, like, too close to the situation to understand or to see that, like, because the expectations are so low, that's why they seem to be working so hard and playing so great. And, like, sometimes a player who works that hard has to work that hard because they're terrible. And that's,
yeah,
like, you have to, as a general manager, this kind of falls more on Lou Lamoriello than it does on Mike Babcock, because all coaches have that blind spot. So it's up to the general manager to cut that off and say, you know, we're not going to bring in that player. We know you like him, Mike, but play Connor Carrick instead because we think he's more versatile.
Well, and I think you said it best, Andrew. It doesn't say very much to your Stanley Cup aspirations when the average fan tunes in and watches an aging, at the end of his career, in his twilight, Ron Hainsey and a Roman Polak commandeering the blue line. Doesn't it speak to the relative value or maybe how difficult it is to get a defensive defenseman? I mean, a real, true defensive shutdown defenseman. I mean, were you at all surprised when Larson came to Edmonton at the price of Taylor Hall, which I think all four of us can agree was a very steep price to pay for what is essentially a shutdown, one-dimensional D-man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say everybody was shocked at that trade, right? And those kinds of guys are relatively rare. Now, they're probably still a little bit overvalued in NHL circles, but like you said, a true defensive defenseman. So not like your Roman Polak or end-of-his-career Douglas Murray or guys like that. Guys like Hjalmarsson, Chris Tanev, Marc-Edouard Vlasic, and Adam Larson isn't on that level, but yeah, Adam Larson. Guys who are actual, real defensive stalwarts who don't hurt you in other areas of the game, they're pretty rare. It's not necessarily what Toronto needs, but I feel like those guys are a little bit easier to acquire than, like, you know, a superstar defenseman. That's just probably not in the cards for Toronto, right? Like, they're not going to acquire an Erik Karlsson or a Drew Doughty unless it's, I don't know. Then again, Drew Doughty's going to be a free agent soon, so maybe they will acquire
imagine.
Drew Doughty. You never know. That would
imagine.
Be a game changer for
sick.
Toronto.
Yet another free agent who is, you know, penned to come to Toronto but never does.
Hey.
Yes. Stamkos, Tavares, Drew Doughty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, and yeah. With is there help on the horizon for the Maple Leafs to shore up that defense? I mean, they don't have – I mean, there is the plethora of offensive depth that they do have, but some of it seems to be struggling now with Bozak not being, you know, as valuable an asset as he once was, as now he's slumping. Andrew, you recently wrote about that. JVR seems to be the big trading chip that the Leafs have that is always mentioned. And also Kadri, do you see any of those three potentially being moved to shore up the Toronto defense?
I can't see them moving Kadri just because he's become so strong under Mike Babcock. Like, Kadri, when Babcock was hired, you know, he was a good player. He was a good offensive player, but he was pretty one-dimensional. And I think that he was challenged when the new regime came in, basically, like, make yourself, you know, a part of this core, not just a player that plugs in as a second-line center or a third-line center. You have to play tough minutes. And last year, Kadri played the toughest minutes of any player in the entire NHL. The second toughest was Komarov, and those two were paired together a lot. And he was phenomenal. Now, he wasn't, you know, Patrice Bergeron shutting down guys like that, but, you know, just as an example, you remember his game where he stripped Connor McDavid of the puck and scored in overtime, which is now, like, legendary in Toronto. things like that.
Yeah, that was great.
He really worked on his game and became much better defensively, and he's still an extremely effective offensive player. So I can't see them moving him just because he's too important, especially like as a guy right behind Austin Matthews. Like, Austin Matthews is the center of the Toronto Maple Leafs core, right? He is everything that they're going to build around, but you need to have someone to back him up. You can't just depend on one guy, and you're seeing that in Edmonton right now with, you know, Draisaitl when he was out and watching McDavid try to do everything on his own. You need somebody else there, and Nazem Kadri is a great player to have.
The Toronto Maple Leafs, which is imagining Uncle Leo Komarov and Nazem Kadri. It's like a punchline of a joke. What happens when they both walk into a bar? All hell breaks loose. There's a lot of whistle scrums, a lot of hits from behind. You know what I'm saying? Like, those are two players that get vilified by, I think, anyone who's outside of the Toronto circle. There's no question, though, they really have become important glue players. What about the Habs, though? Who are their Komarov and Kadri equivalents that their fans can rely on to help them through those tough periods where you need some sandpaper in games that you're having trouble scoring?
Yeah, well, I guess to jump in, you'd have to say at the forefront, Brendan Gallagher. Like, even you know, when they were having like their rough stretches and stuff, Gallagher was one of the players who actually didn't look too bad. You know, he was doing what he usually does, is getting in front of the net, you know, working along the boards and making those type of plays. So I probably him and Andrew Shaw, probably who are the quote unquote, you know, the menace or like the goblins or the rats that, you know, the other teams kind of see and don't really want to play with or get annoyed by easily. But, you know, every team has their go-to rat and stuff. And, you know, fortunately Gallagher seems like he's like on the rise of having a better season than he did last year. I think last year he only had like 11 goals and now he's up to 3 or 4. So, you know, he's definitely trending in the right direction. And, you know, that's definitely one thing that the Habs are going to want moving forward. If they're going to, you know, make this 3-3 wins in 4 game stretch that they've had like a consistent thing, opposed to just like a flash in the pan type of thing.
Yeah, I was really concerned with Gallagher the past couple of years, because ever since he broke his hand, not once, but twice, you could clearly see that everything lost on his shot. And Gallagher is not exactly the fastest skater. He doesn't have exactly the best hands. He's more of a work hard to get his goals, and losing his, I'm not sure how bad he let on that his hand injuries were, but I think it seems to be that he's turned the game around for himself. Because, and I'm wondering how much that has to do with maybe further healing of his hands. I mean, I wish we knew how badly they were injured, but I think that might have something to do with it. Is there any indication of that, maybe, like in terms of, or is he just getting into the right areas of the ice to score his goals now?
I mean, his hand's definitely better than it was last season, but he did let on last season that it's his left hand that was broken, so it's not his like power hand for shooting. It's more, you know, holding the top of the stick. But he said that it would never be 100% again. So there is some limitation there in mobility and maybe the power of his grip on his stick. But, you know, Gallagher, I think, is a guy who I think a lot of people underestimate his skill, because he's such a work hard guy that forechecks so hard, and everyone thinks that, you know, he's not the most skilled guy, but I think his skill is really underrated. And you can see that this year by the amount that he's been able to become a playmaker. I think he's diversified his game a little bit, where he's making more high-end passes, especially in the slot area, setting up his teammates. Charles Hudon has been a big beneficiary of that. I think he's made Tomas Pekanic look a lot better than he really is. He combines that hard work with smart play. You know, Brendan Gallagher has always been a very smart player, and he may not be, you know, an absolute speed demon, but when he has the puck on his stick, he's one of those guys that's a little bit faster than when he doesn't have it. And I think he exemplified that against the Senators last game, where he not only stripped Erik Karlsson of the puck, but then beat Mark Stone, who's the Senators' best forward and best defensive forward, and then beat Cody Ceci to make Craig Anderson look terrible on a fantastic goal, probably the best goal of his entire career.
Yeah, that was very, very nice. You mentioned Plekanec. Is Plekanec essentially done? I mean, we're never going to see him, I guess, score the 20 goals per season that he got for 7 years in a row. I mean, is he... I know he's valuable as a defensive forward, but and this is his last year of his contract, but what does the future hold for Thomas Kukanits?
I mean, I'd say in terms of being an impact forward, he's done. He can probably be a bottom six guy for a couple more years, but he'd have to take a hefty pay cut to stay with the Canadiens, I would assume. And I don't know if he's necessarily going to be a center for much longer. It's just too taxing on him. And, you know, Thomas Bucanic, he does some things defensively still that are good, but his defensive game has declined just as much as his offensive game. He's not the great checker that he used to be. He doesn't have the quickness that he used to have. He doesn't have the hands that he used to have. That stuff goes away. You know, outside of Jaromir Jagr, age waits for no man, and he's 35 now. It's natural for him to lose some level of ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to build off that, I think that's why a lot of Habs fans are so keen on a player like Michael McCarron, just because, you know, if obviously, you know, we all think that this is the last year for Plekanec, you know, like Andrew said, unless he decides to take a pay cut. But, you know, that third line center spot is open for McCarron next year full time, or even this year, you know, like even though him and Sherbak were called up as injury replacements, you know, McCarron, if he continues to play as well as he has been in these last few games, he could easily stay in the lineup for the rest of the season. So, you know, if he can round out his game and maybe become that shutdown player, or that defensively responsible guy that Plekanec what has been for the Montreal Canadiens for a number of years, then probably having Plekanec, you know, move on from the organization is going to be an easier pill to swallow than before.
Yeah, I would say for Mike McCarron, there's a lot of things that he's got to work on to even be an NHL player in my mind. I think he looked closer to being an NHL player 2 years ago than he does right now, to me. You know, playing alongside Alex Galchenyuk makes him look a little bit better, but in terms of his, like, puck handling and, you know, his ability to win puck battles for his size, I haven't been very impressed. He's got to work a little bit harder, and I don't know if it's necessarily a conditioning thing or if it's just, you know, a guy that big, it takes a little bit longer for his body to grow up the same way that a smaller player would. You know, like, he doesn't have man strength yet, maybe, but he's got to have a lot more attention to detail and think a lot quicker to be an NHL player for me.
I guess that's an interesting segue. Can we start talking about Alex Galchenyuk still on the fourth line?
Before we do that, let's take a call, because we've got a caller coming in here on the Habs Fan versus Leafs Fan Roundtable with Andrew Burchard, Omar White, and Kamal Rahman. Let's go to the lines now. Go ahead. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Jeff. I'm calling from Mississauga.
Jeff from Mississauga. Go ahead. You're on the HVL Roundtable.
I have a question. Actually, it's more Montreal Canadiens related. With their inconsistent play and the way that they've been playing, do you foresee what type of changes Montreal is going to do, whether it's minor tinkering for trades, or are we going to see front office completely wiped out and replaced, or are we going to see some wholesale changes and perhaps Montreal even bottoming out?
I don't know. It does seem, you know, that firing, you know, Bergevin and the rest of the management does seem like the easiest thing. And obviously, you know, a big trade is something that Bergevin hasn't been scared to do over these last few years. But I think what they're going to do, at least for the time being, is sit and wait. And because, like, in the press conference Bergevin had, like, last week, he kind of harped on the fact that, you know, he doesn't want to make a quote-unquote panic move or a desperate move and stuff. And sure, they have that $8.5 million of cap space. But I do think that, you know, even if things trend down south, like, just like how – maybe not exactly how it was in that 2014-2015 season, but kind of similar to that, I still think that they'd be okay to stand back and just wait, just because of the fact that, you know, Johnny T might be waiting for them on July 1st at free agency, and they'll probably do whatever they can and throw as much money as they can at him to try to get him signed. So, you know, to say they're gonna do something, you know, the easiest answer would be to say no, but you know, you never know. And you know, the pressure and the microscope and the eyes are always around Montreal. And you know, if they're like really hovering around that playoff spot come the trade deadline, you know, you have to think that they might do something to spark things up.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see them blowing it up simply because if they do, that would have to be Marc Bergevin admitting, you know, a colossal failure. Because if you're blowing up this team, you're essentially saying that the best group of players that the Canadiens have had since they were winning Stanley Cups on the regular, they weren't able to get it done with it, right? So, like, if you're blowing it up, that means you're getting rid of Carey Price, you're getting rid of Max Pacioretty, you're getting rid of Shea Weber. Like, you're starting from scratch with as many assets as you can, because you can't blow things up and expect those players to still be around when you're competing 5, 6, 7 years from now. So if that were to happen, if they were decided to do that, I would expect that Marc Bergevin would be gone as soon as that decision is made, because if you can't trust the guy to fix the situation, then you probably won't trust him to rebuild the situation, you know? So it wouldn't be part of, or it wouldn't be a typical kind of situation that you would expect from the NHL, which is a very conservative league. I agree that they're going to try to wait it out. I don't think they're going to get Tavares, even if they think they're going to get Tavares, and that's the plan. I mean, it's clear that they've been saving cap space for something, but I just can't see that happening. You know, maybe if Tavares' his best friend was still on the Canadiens, then maybe that would happen, but they traded him a couple summers ago, so that's probably not going to be too enticing for John Tavares. I just don't see why Tavares would leave Long Island for a team like Montreal when, you know, there are other teams that have a much better chance of winning a Stanley Cup in the near future. And plus, you're looking at probably $10, $11 million a year for Tavares. Can you pay that to him and Carey Price at the same time? That's pretty tough.
It's an interesting question, because the answer is kind of twofold for myself. What I want is, I don't want anyone, I don't like it when anyone gets fired, but I would like a different leadership group in Montreal. Now, what I think will happen is that I think Bergevin will stay essentially for the end of the season. I just find the direction that the Montreal Canadiens are taking, that Marc Bergevin has taken the Montreal Canadiens in, is fundamentally different from all the other recent Stanley Cup champions, in that he's building from the goaltender out. As we obviously know, Price, he's just signed the long-term deal. He's got Shea Weber long-term till he's 40 years old. He likes to get the Carl Alsners of the world, or the Jordy Benz of the world as well. More of a, you know, maybe an early 2000s looking kind of defense with the goaltender back in the Dallas Stars kind of day, with the Darian Hatchers and the Ed Belfours. And obviously he's still got the whole big holes at center. So it's just, I don't see how Montreal can eventually become a winner when the way to get those players is through the draft. And as Marc Bergevin has said, getting good draft, you have to finish close to the bottom, and he doesn't want to finish close to the bottom. So, and then as we just talked about with John Tavares, I agree, it's going to be a very hard sell for Tavares to come to Montreal. And so if you can't get a good center through free agency, and you can't get good centers through drafts, and good centers win you Stanley Cups, how are the Montreal Canadiens going to turn this thing around? It's a little bit of a, you know, one of those finger traps that you just can't get yourself out of. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I feel like if they would have built in a different way, you know, like, you can build from the goalie out. I feel like just because certain kinds of teams have won recently doesn't necessarily mean that another style can't win. You know, like, you probably could win without a top-flight center, but you have to be a lot smarter. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just build around Carey Price and sign a bunch of shot blockers and expect to not allow any goals, right? Like, if you truly believe that Carey Price is the best goaltender in the world and he's a huge difference maker, then what you should be doing is putting all your money outside of Carey Price into offense. And that's not just in forwards, but in defensemen too. Your entire focus should be on piling up goals, because you should be thinking, if we play a run-and-gun style, we're going to win because we have Carey Price and they don't. So that should have been the focus from day one for Marc Bergevin, and it wasn't. They didn't really have a clear focus, and I think they've really undermined themselves by going in multiple different directions. Like, for a while, it seemed like Marc Bergevin really liked mobile puck-moving defensemen, and that was all they went for. And at one point, you know, they had Markov and Subban and Petrie and Beaulieu and all this promise on the back end, and then now all of a sudden it's conservative guys that block a lot of shots and stay close to the net and don't move the puck much. And, you know, if you keep changing your mind every 2 years, you're never going to have that, you know, 5-year build that good teams have that results in this excellent core that propels you to a Stanley Cup. So maybe there was no chance they were ever going to get a top-flight center, but they could have built in a way that compensated for that, and they just never found out how to do it.
So based on that, you know, I think the comment on how the Habs were working in different directions is actually a pretty good point. So, you know, if everything's resulted to what we have now, where it's, you know, a team that, you know, they tried to shore up the defense, they tried to shore up the center position, you know, are we at a point where they're better off just starting over instead of actually trying to continue with this?
The best thing they could do probably isn't to keep going down this same road, but at the same time, they can't not, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, it would be such a PR nightmare for the Canadians, who are already kind of having trouble selling tickets in Montreal, to just give up. Like, they have no choice but to try to keep, you know, saying hit me and trying to lock into a Stanley Cup, because you never know. Things can happen, you know. Like, I don't think the Bruins in 2011 were a great hockey team. They lucked into that Stanley Cup from Tim Thomas playing out of this world. And, you know, they happened to break Max Pacioretty's neck before the playoffs and play the Canadians and win 3 games in overtime when they probably should have been out in the first round. You know, like, sometimes things like that happen and you can have a miracle run. I don't think the Pittsburgh Penguins should have won last year. They didn't play very well in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So you can maybe hope against all hope that something crazy happens and the Canadians luck out and win a Stanley Cup. And then you can go down and say, aha, it was the plan all along. We were brilliant. But if you don't keep trying and you just give up, maybe you'll be better in 10 years, but everyone's going to hate you for making that right decision, because you're not going to be the one who's there to benefit from that decision. So for a general manager and a coach and everybody who's in charge of the Canadians right now, there's no personal benefit to making the right decision, which kind of sucks for fans.
Yeah. Let's take another call and we can continue on that point. You are on the Habs Fan versus Leafs Fan round panel. Go ahead. What's your name and where are you calling from?
It's Paul from Peterborough.
Paul from Peterborough. Go ahead. You're on with Andrew Berkshire, Omar White, and Kamal Rahman.
It's a pleasure, guys. I love the podcast. Very entertaining. I've been playing this little game with my friends. I just want to see what your guys' opinion is on it. It's basically what if. What if Matthews had went to Winnipeg, and what if Laney was here in Toronto? Does Matthews score 40 goals? I don't know if he does out there, but anyway, he's a hell of a player. But does Laney play wing, Marner center, or Nylander center? Because remember, Toronto drafted Marner to play center. They said that. I wonder how the shakeup would be and how those players would perform in the different cities. Get your opinion on that.
Oh, my heart just stopped imagining a world where Austin Matthews wasn't in Toronto. okay, well, yeah, he actually has a good point, because, you know, right when after, you know, the Leafs drafted Matthews, all the reporters went to Babcock, and the first thing he said was that he's going to try Nylander on the wing with Matthews. And at the end of that season, Nylander finished, you know, played 22 games playing center. So I guess if it was Line A instead of Matthews, then you'd probably still have Nylander down the middle, and then probably Line A. I don't know if Line A would be on Nylander's wing, but maybe he might be on Kadri's. I don't know. It's iffy. And then on the other side, if Matthews is in Winnipeg, so he's playing with Shifley, he's playing with Little, he's playing with Ehlers. So that actually, he could get close. To be honest, he may actually have had a close offensive production in Winnipeg than he did in Toronto. What do you guys think?
I personally think that if Matthews were in Winnipeg, he probably wouldn't have usurped Scheifele as the number one center, just because Scheifele is established. So let's assume that he doesn't get Ehlers on his wing. But he would probably get Blake Wheeler then, right? And, you know, like, all due respect to Willie Nylander, who I think is a very good player. Very little respect to Zach Hyman, who I think is a good third liner but should never be on Austin Matthews' wing. if you had Blake Wheeler playing with Austin Matthews, man, I think he puts up just as much, if not more. You know, Austin Matthews is so good. He impresses me so much every time I watch him play. And, you know, the numbers back it up. Everything says that this guy is super elite. I think that if you put it on Winnipeg, it wouldn't really matter for him. He would still put that puck home as many times as you would expect. Line A would be a pretty different situation in Toronto. I guess more pressure would be on him because Toronto was rebuilding. And, you know, maybe we wouldn't be sitting here saying that Toronto is getting close to being a Stanley Cup contender because they'd be, you know, it's one more winger on a team that has a lot of really good wingers and needs those two-way centers. I don't think Mitch Marner would be in the middle because I just don't think Mike Babcock would trust him enough defensively to ever play him in the middle. Willie Nylander, maybe his grooming would be a little bit different, right? But, you know, without Austin Matthews up the middle for Toronto, I think they'd be a significantly worse team. I think both players went to the teams that needed them more.
I just wonder about how teams would play Matthews in the West a hell of a lot different, a lot of heavier game. I know Matthews got the speed, but sometimes when you watch him play in the West against the West teams, they tend to really they focus on him. They know how to play defense. But I agree with the board there saying that, you know, he can probably play anywhere and he would have Wheeler's a good addition to it. But I still have a feeling the West just checked better. Goals are way down in the West, but I still think Laney, I wouldn't doubt, would score 60 here. But you're right, who would be his centerman and where would he play? But you'd put him on top line. I like how Babcock runs the game. All of a sudden, Matthew sneaks on. Like, how many times has Matthew snuck on the ice or Kadri gets hit in the arm and he's on and it's a 2-on-1, 2-on-1, 2-on-1? Now, I know I get in trouble for saying this, but Matthew really does like to cheat. I don't think he's such a this back checker like everybody says he is. But he does hang high a lot and gets caught a lot. And I think that Babcock lets him get away with it, but Paul Maurice doesn't. And Laine has been benched several times. And I think last game he only played 13 minutes. So I have a feeling that Laine was here, he's a Timo Salani. 50, 60 goals, boom, boom, all year. So, but I, you know, I'm starting to sway now after you talk about the middle, because you're right, the Toronto Maple Leafs need a centerman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Paul, about, that made about the West being tougher on Austin Matthews, because actually I believe it was Pierre McGuire who said that whoever is going to play against Austin Matthews should watch how San Jose played against Austin Matthews in that game the other night. They said they played a perfect game against him, and obviously the results spoke for themselves as San Jose did come out on top in that game. So, I mean, it is an interesting point because we do hear that the West is a heavier conference. So, but I think that Austin, he's a big body. He seems to play the 200-foot game really, really well. And he is young, so even if he might have a challenge initially with the West, I don't foresee it being for a very long time because he just seems like a special, special player.
Some great questions there from Paul. Let's get back to what we were talking about, though, before we took that call, which was the importance of leadership and understanding where the front offices are guiding their respective teams. And one of the things that I've noticed watching Maple Leafs games over the last few days especially is that there are more and more shots of Lou Lamoriello and Brendan Shanahan looking like really old men kind of overseeing a great project. And when things don't go well, they're not really visibly angry, but you know it's bothering them. I'm wondering, do you guys think that a big trade will be had if this front office senses that there is an opportunity to do a seriously long extended playoff run, or are they just going to keep playing it year by year, giving kind of like a free rein to this Babcock contract, knowing that this is his team through thick and thin?
Well, I think one thing we have to take in consideration is, you know, even though this year there's a whole bunch of expectations around the Toronto Maple Leafs, the most of them have been driven by us fans and the media. You know, from ever since, you know, like even before Babcock was here, you know, when they finally decided like, hey, okay, we're going to be bad, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to build this the right way, and then we're going to, you know, slowly build to being deemed a year in year out Stanley Cup contender. But you know, management's never actually come out and said like, hey, you know, we think that we can actually do something this year. And I think because of that, the team isn't going to be as, I guess, as willing, I guess, to make to make a big move or a big trade unless they actually think it's necessary. For example, last year when they traded for Brian Boyle, the one thing that Lou Lamoriello said afterwards is, you know, like, you know, we thought that at the beginning of the season, you know, we had our thoughts around the team. Then they progressively got better, and then we did this trade to kind of I guess show to the players like, hey, we believe that you guys can make the playoffs this year. Take Brian Boyle, have some fun, right? So I do think even though there are these expectations and people think that the Leafs can make the Eastern Conference Final, they can make a Stanley Cup Final, whatever they're gonna say. But I do think that management themselves, they have their own beliefs and they have their own thoughts on to what this team is and what they can do this year. And if it gets to the point where they do believe that they can actually do something special, then I think they'll make that move. But if there's a chance where it's not gonna go that way, then I think they might just let things run their course.
The Leafs, they've always said that they're going to stick with their plan, and whether that's sacrificing some of their younger talent, which they do have a lot of back actually on the Marlies, they've got a ton of young forwards that they still can actually use as assets to trade. But I mean, Shanahan has always been steadfast, and Lamoriello has been steadfast in that they're going to stick to the program and stick to the plan. I think that's been the problem with the past several regimes that have run the Toronto Maple Leafs, is that the moment they got any hint of slight success or thought that they were getting closer, they would just kind of jump the gun and sacrifice the young talent, and it wouldn't be the right moves. And then, of course, it was just kind of a rinse and repeat kind of scenario. So I don't know if Toronto will make that sort of big move as of yet. I think right now the current situation is showing that they're just not there yet. I mean, I think next year might be the time where something might happen with a bigger trade, but especially with everyone still on entry-level contracts, there's still a lot of room for them to make some moves. So it'll be interesting to see what the Leafs do.
Yeah, and to Kamal's point, you know, Toronto doesn't need any more David Clarksons running around. So.
Ooh, David Clarkson, he is who I thought was.
Yeah, I would say the one thing that Toronto needs to be careful of, yeah, I would say the one thing Toronto needs to be careful of if they're too conservative is, you know, it's really tough to win a Stanley Cup. You know, you can be the best team in the NHL for a period of 5 years, like, say, the San Jose Sharks were, and never win. You know, not even get to the Stanley Cup Finals in the prime of your best players' careers. You know, they only had that one miracle run where they didn't win 2 years ago. So if... Mm-hmm. there's any chance whatsoever that the Toronto Maple Leafs are legitimate Stanley Cup contenders this year, I'm not saying they need to move heaven and earth to improve their team, but, you know, take advantage of deals that are there that aren't going to hurt you long term and extend your window for an extra year. If you think you're going to be even better next year, just don't sacrifice anything for next year. You know, like, you can send off some draft picks. The Leafs are full of prospects. You know, they don't even really need any more for the next couple of years. So you can move some prospects. You can move some depth players. You can move some picks to make your team better in the short run and not really sacrifice much. You know what I mean? So I would say that if they are comfortable competing for a Stanley Cup this year, they should really try to go for it, because anything can happen in hockey. It's such a random league in a lot of ways. You have to take advantage of every opportunity you have.
That's a great point, Andrew. So, I mean, it's essentially saying that there is a window that exists in hockey where Mark Bergevin seems to not want to admit that there is a window.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, he's got to see that essentially his three key players, and I'm jumping over to the Montreal Canadiens here, but Carey Price, as we talked about earlier, is 30 years old. Shea Weber is over 30. And Pacioretty is also getting up there in age. And could it be said that their three key players have already reached their prime and are essentially potentially on the slow downfall of their career?
I think that's totally fair.
Yeah. Like Weber, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I mean, Price isn't going to get any better either, right? Like, well, he'll get better than his numbers so far this year, but, like, he's not going to be better than his Hart Trophy year. He's probably not going to give you that year again, really. I mean, goaltenders in their 30s, they don't necessarily decline really quickly, but, you know, he's not going to be the best goaltender in the world for all of his next contract. You know, it's just not the way it works. And Max Pacioretty, I think he's still a top 10 winger in the NHL, but how long will that be when he's 29 years old now, 30 next year? He's a very versatile player. He's a little bit like Marian Hossa Light in a lot of ways. So maybe his career extends further than most people give it credit for. But like you said, like Weber, he's already not what he used to be. He's very limited in what he can do in the middle of the ice, especially in the neutral zone. So there's issues there. I mean, they do have some young players who can help them out, in like Jonathan Drouin and Arturi Lehkonen and Charles Hudon and Alex Galchenyuk, but you have to trust those players. And unfortunately, they don't seem to trust Alex Galchenyuk. So unless they're willing to give those players tons of minutes to grow and be their best, I don't see how their window gets much wider.
Can we stick on the whole on this whole trust topic? Because like Kamal and Ari, like we've talked about this, you know, on and off air about the decision not to put Galchenyuk in the center, and even still, you know, we're a month in and I still don't get it. And I was really set on the fact, you know, in the summer that, you know, when they said like, oh, you know, we see Galchenyuk as a winger and not a center, I legitimately thought it was just, you know, it was just a little thing just to light a flame underneath him and, you know, get him to work hard over the summer and stuff. But, you know, to see even still that, you know, they're not even like willing to give it a little sniff, you know, even when, you know, you have like Jacob DeLaRose and Michael McCarron, you talked about earlier, all playing center and in front of him, like is the team just being stubborn, or is there something that we're not seeing that the management is like? Andrew, I know you wrote your article about it on Sportsnet, so like let us know like what's going on, because I don't get it, I don't see it.
Yeah, it's one of those situations I think where a team has made up their mind and they're not willing to look past it. You know, they want Alex Galchenyuk to be a certain thing and he's not that thing. So because he's not that thing, they've just kind of like shoved him to the side and they're not worrying about it anymore. Instead of recognizing what he actually is, which is essentially a very good second line center, you know, they can't see that, because all they can see is he's not a first line center. So get him out of here and we'll figure it out later. We'll put him on the wing, let him toil. And even though he scored 3 goals in the last 4 games, there doesn't seem to be any promotion coming up for him. It's a really weird situation, and this happens a lot in pro sports, right, where you have a young prospect and you envision him to be a certain way and they don't work out that way, but they're still a useful player, but that team can't figure out what that usefulness translates to because they're so stuck on what they aren't. It happened with Lars Eller in Montreal, right? Like, they traded Yaroslav Halak for him, who had this miracle run, and therefore Lars Eller had to be this great impact player. Well, he ended up being a really good third-line center, and that wasn't good enough, so they sent him somewhere else. You know, like they could never figure out where to put him, what line mates to give him. It just never really worked out for them. So it's not a rare thing. It's not like an unusual thing, but it's unfortunate that it happened to the Canadiens with a player as good as Alex Galchenyuk, because he is legitimately a very, very good player.
So if that's the case, you know, like we all know that Galchenyuk is a great player, and you know, if the best place for him is down the middle, but the team isn't willing to do that, they can't let him stay on the fourth line the whole season, right? So, can we not say that he's probably going to be traded by the end of the season?
It's hard to imagine that they would just let him sit on the fourth line the entire time.
Yeah. And the Galchenyuk for Chris Kreider rumors seem to be growing by the day. And again, it's kind of a mind-boggling thing with Chris Kreider being a winger. I mean, Montreal needs centers. It seems to be that not only fans like myself, but also experts say that Galchenyuk can be a centerman. So why is Montreal potentially, I mean, rumors are rumors, but why does it seem to be that they're targeting Chris Kreider?
Yeah, it seems like Chris Kreider is, you know, that old thing that the Canadiens keep going after is size, right? And maybe they want somebody who can insulate Max Pacioretty a little bit, you know, a second large winger who can score. But the thing is, like, Chris Kreider, I don't understand this trade because it's the last thing that they need. you know, we can already look at what they have on the left wing, and they're fine there. They're deep enough. They don't need Chris Kreider. And I like Chris Kreider. I think he's a good player, although I can't imagine, you know, Carey Price wants to play with Chris Kreider on his team. You know, some things are buried, but you can tell every time the Rangers and the Canadians play each other, there's still anger there. And I think Carey Price knows exactly what Chris Kreider's intent was on that play. I'd be very surprised if that trade ends up happening, especially when, like, man, if you're going to trade Alex Galchenyuk, like, I get it to a certain extent that if they decide that Galchenyuk will be a winger no matter what, Chris Kreider is a better winger than Alex Galchenyuk is a winger. But Alex Galchenyuk is a better center than Kreider is a winger. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where they've made their bed and they're going to have to lie in it if they remove Galchenyuk, or else they're going to have to put him further up in the lineup and get him to show that he is what he used to be when he scored 30 goals. Otherwise, they're going to be trading from a position of, you know, pennies on the dollar.
I felt it would be prudent to interject here and mention that I looked up Mikhail Sergachev's stats, not because I have anything to say, but more so along the lines of appreciating, guys, we know that there's a cultural aspect to it, and of course here at HVL we've written some sketches and poked some fun at that. I've asked the question before whether it was a Russian issue, because a lot of Russian defensemen that this team could really use right now are absent. And I'm wondering, will that really come back to haunt this team, knowing that you need left-handed puck-carrying defensemen in order to be successful on your special teams the way the Habs play them? And also, how do you measure Jonathan Drouin's season as a kind of baseline of success against what Sergachev does? I mean, if he continues to have this Victor Hedman-like first year in the NHL, won't that be even more heat on Bergevin for letting a surefire 19-year-old prospect go?
I don't think so, because Jonathan Drouin's been fantastic. I think it's easy to look at what Sergachev's doing in Tampa Bay and say, like, oh, well, if the Canadians had this, their defense would be so much better. But ultimately, I don't think that he would have this kind of point production on the Canadians. You know, he's not playing with Stamkos and Kucherov, who are red hot to start the year. And what you'd end up having is, you know, Victor Mete wouldn't be on the team. Sergachev would be with Weber. And, you know, like, that's a much tougher job than what he's doing in Tampa Bay, so you'd probably see him more exposed defensively. Mete wouldn't make the team, and you'd still be stuck with Carl Alsner. So, like, the bad decisions would still be there. You'd just sub in a different player, and then you wouldn't have another young player getting the opportunity, and you wouldn't have Jonathan Drouin, and you still wouldn't have Alex Radulov. So, like, it's kind of like one of those things where it's funny to point out how great Sergachev is doing, and it's easy to make fun of the Canadians for it because they need an offensive defenseman, but I don't think that it's, you know, an intellectually honest comparison, and it's too easy to ignore how great Jonathan Drouin's been when you're looking at that comparison, because, you know, maybe he doesn't have as many points as Sergachev yet, but I think he will far outdo him by the end of the season, and Drouin's been just brilliant all year long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to build off that point, you know, like, and trying to find out, like, how you compare the two by the end of the year. Well, the Habs traded for Drouin because they saw that he can be a center for their team in the NHL. You know, by the end of the season, you know, if they're right, and, you know, and Drouin continues to play as well as he's been doing playing the whole season, then I guess that's your draw marker there, right? So even though, like, to what you guys are saying, it's easy to make all those comparisons and say, like, oh, you know, Sergachev has like 10 points or something like that, and Drouin only has 8. But, like, yeah, but, you know, the Habs traded from their pool for a player that they felt can fill a specific role, and he's doing that so far. So, you know, if at the end of the day that's what the result is, then I guess there's no way you can look at that trade and shake your head. You know, obviously there are other trades you could do that for, but, you know, we're not going to get into that. So,
no, I agree. I think essentially with what both of you have said in regards to Sergachev, I agree that he probably won't be putting up these types of numbers with the Montreal Canadiens, especially the way their offense is built. And I'm not sure if Claude Julien he's obviously playing Victor Mete, but maybe his system won't allow for as much freedom as Mikhail Sergachev is getting.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got another caller here. Let's bring them on board. What's your name and where are you calling from? You're on the Habs Fan vs. Leafs Fan Roundtable.
Gavin DeHuda.
Gavin, go ahead. What's your question?
So I just wanted to know, like, the Leafs need to improve on defense. I just wanted to know what was available.
Who was available? That's a great question, Gavin. Guys, let's talk about that. If the Maple Leafs are going to upgrade their capacity towards a strong playoff run, what will that take? Let's start with you, Andrew. What do they have to do in order to be looked at as a legitimate Stanley Cup contender on the defensive side?
I think they only need one guy, and they need to, you know, shuffle the bottom of the lineup as well, because I don't think Roman Polak can keep up to their style of play. You know, just get Connor Carrick back in there, that'll help, but they definitely need somebody on that top pairing, either with Morgan Rielly or Jake Gardiner, whoever you decide is the guy you want to run with on that side. I would look at a guy like Chris Tanev. I know that Vancouver is asking for an absurd return for him, because obviously, despite Vancouver's place in the standings, they're not a good team and they're not going to make the playoffs. They're still in rebuild mode. I think Chris Tanev could be a perfect fit in Toronto, but you're going to have to argue them down. And, you know, we don't know for sure that that hasn't been happening for the last year and a half, you know? Like, Toronto could be just working the phones and trying to figure out that trade as we speak. So I think it's just a matter of time before they fill it, and Tanev would be a perfect fit.
Yeah, and to build off that point, you know, even though we can throw out a whole bunch of names now, you know, by March or February, you know, there could be someone who wasn't available at the beginning of the season who could be available now, or on the other on the other side of the coin there, you know, there could be a player that the Leafs have been, you know, have been intrigued in for the past year or two, you know, who the GM of that team, you know, finally kind of like, kind of, I guess, brings down his price a little bit and agrees to a trade. So, you know, there could be a name as we speak that the Leafs have been inquiring about that we may not even know. But I guess we'll just have to see if they're willing to pull the trigger on that type of deal.
I'm not sure how strong or truthful these rumors are, but there seems to be a lot of scouts looking at Nick Leddy of the New York Islanders, and I think he'd be able to help the Toronto Maple Leafs defensive. And for sure, I mean, he's a great mobile defenseman, and I'm just not sure why the Islanders are trading him. And, in fact, he'd also be a good fit for the Montreal Canadiens, too.
I think he'd be a better fit for the Canadiens than the Leafs, because the Canadiens need some transition from the back end, which, you know, Leddy is brilliant at. But in terms of what Toronto needs, I don't think he quite fits the profile, right? Because they need a guy who's really good defensively and especially defending against controlled entries. Leddy's not that good defensively. Without the puck, he's a bit of a risk, and I'm assuming that's why the Islanders don't love him very much. I think he's still a very good defenseman, but his skill set is definitely more towards moving the puck up the ice and generating offense than it is defense.
So, Andrew, is there, like, are the Canadians expressing interest in Leddy? Do you know if that's concrete or anything like that?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, we've seen Mark Bergevin scouting at Islanders games, but everyone assumes that's about John Tavares, which, you know, I don't know. At the same time, like, do you think that they really need to scout John Tavares at this point? Like, oh, I wonder, watching an Islanders practice, if I can learn about John Tavares. I think they know who it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Gavin, that was a great question. Have you got any others you want to ask before we let you go?
I just wanted to know, the Leafs backup goalie, do the Leafs need to upgrade the backup?
Okay, that's a good question.
That's a good question.
We know that they started the year with Curtis McElhinney, who I think we can all agree is an adequate backup, but then they picked up Calvin Pickard, or Pickard, depending on how you like to pronounce it, south or north of the border.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start with you, Omar? How do you feel about the Maple Leafs backup goaltending situation?
It's shaky because, you know, like when you think of McElhinney, like the one thing that comes to mind, obviously, is, you know, is that big save he had on Crosby at the end of last season, right? But, you know, if to be a backup in the NHL, you know, you have to be able to play 500 hockey. You know, you have to play the second half of those back to backs and give your team a chance to win. And, you know, I'm not really confident in the fact that he can do that for the entire season. And I think, and obviously that's not the core reason of why the Leafs decided to trade for Pickard. I think, you know, I think they saw the opportunity to acquire him once once Vegas put him on waivers. But I do think that the Leafs having Pickard in the system does shorten the leash that McElhinney has. And we know what happened last year. You know, if Babcock disfavors the goalie, you know, he's not shy of showing them the door. So I do think for now, like, McElhinney is doing what he can. Yeah, he's a little too frantic for my liking, but you know, he stops the puck more than often. But I do think that if he does have a stretch of games where he struggles, Pickard, or even maybe Sparks can get the call up. I do think, even though Matt McElhinney does have a two-year deal, I think by next year, you know, assuming both are still with the organization, Sparks or Pickard could be fighting for that job. So we'll have to wait and see.
That was an excellent question, Gavin. Thanks for calling into the show. Gentlemen, I think this has been fantastic. I think we need to wrap it up now. We've got some time constraints as well we have to deal with. Once again, you've been listening to Andrew Berkshire, Omar White, and Kamal Ramag on the Habs Fan vs. Leafs Fan Roundtable Podcast. Everyone have a great night. See you soon.